Well, good evening. We are in lesson number 10. If you need a lesson sheet, raise your hand. Josh has a few extras and we can get those to you. Okay. Great. For those who are joining us on Zoom, first of all, welcome. And second of all, if you want to, you can go ahead and go to our website, springschurchofchrist.org, and you can download the PowerPoint. I know it's difficult to read on the screen, so you can follow along that way. We are now looking at the second lesson in regards to Paul, and honestly, Paul deserves more than two lessons. We could probably pretty easily do an entire class on just Paul and his actions and his character and his books. Wait, no, that's way, way, way more than one class, isn't it? There's a lot about Paul, and we're just going to get to look at a little bit regarding him right now. So let's look over in Acts chapter 9. In the book of Acts, you have several transitions that are occurring as you get from the beginning to the end of the book. The outline of the book of Acts is in Acts chapter 1 when Jesus gives us a geographic outline. Jesus says, you're going to be a witness for me in Jerusalem, then Judea and Samaria, and then the remotest parts of the earth. And so as you go through the book of Acts, that's the transition you're seeing. You also see a transition where there is a focus on converting Jews, and then it starts to transition to be more of a focus on the Gentiles. Along with both of those, there's a transition from a focus on Peter to a focus on Paul. And so Paul becomes the focus of the second half of the book of Acts. And we start with Paul, really for us, in the conversion in chapter 9. We talked about last week the pre-conversion attributes of Paul. But in Acts chapter 9, Paul is on the road to Damascus. His intent is to catch Christians, arrest them, and bring them back to Jerusalem for trial. As he is on the way, he sees in the middle of the day a bright light, and he encounters Jesus, and Jesus informs him that you've been persecuting me, and Paul falls down, and he's given instructions to go to Damascus and to wait. He'll be told what he needs to be told. And Ananias is in Damascus, and Jesus comes to Ananias and says, I want you to go to Paul, or Saul, and I want you to tell him the things that he needs to know. And Ananias finds that quite peculiar, because this is Saul, the great persecutor, and he's there to persecute Christians. Why would I want to go talk to him? And so if we pick up in verse 15, the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel, for I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake. So Ananias is told that that Saul is going to be a chosen instrument for Jesus. He's going to be an apostle. Ananias has been told one thing more, and that is, well, a few things more. He's going to be in front of royalty. He's going to suffer. And that's really where we want to focus, the suffering of Paul. Now, I'm going to make an assumption here, and my assumption is that Ananias did not keep that secret. When he went and told Saul, he told Saul what Jesus had said. Now, we see some of that in Acts chapter 22. We don't see everything that was stated, but when it is being recounted, in Acts 22 and verse 14, Ananias said, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth, for you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name. Now I'm going to assume that there's more being said than just what was right there. Included with that was, you've been chosen, you're an instrument of the Lord's work, and you're going to suffer. And that's where we start off. Paul knew from the beginning this was not going to be easy. I'm going to suffer. So I want to ask a few questions. The first one's not up here, actually. I want to start off with asking, why did Saul become a Christian? Why would he go ahead and be baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of his sins if he knew what was going to happen if he did that? If he knew that his life that he previously had, this life that was on this meteoric rise, he was famous, he was educated, he was going to be powerful, why would he go ahead and be baptized when he's been told, here's what's going to happen, you're going to suffer? Why would he do it? Alex, then Ashley.
Well, to me, I would think that if you're walking over to Damascus and somebody has the ability to make you blind, somebody has the ability to give you that vision, I mean, all of his life of Christ knowledge did not come from man or from other, you know, basically from other men. It came directly from Jesus himself. If Jesus has that kind of power, that right there is motivation alone to say, okay.
Yeah, you didn't tell him what would happen if you didn't become a Christian, but we have a pretty good idea. Ashley, what were you going to say?
Well, I just think that as intense as he was as a persecutor, he was every bit, his regret was that intense also. When he talked to Jesus out on the road and found out that everything that he'd been doing was completely wrong. And we read in Acts 9 that he went without food or drink for 3 days. Praying. Sounds like someone who has been really, really affected in a big way by what Jesus told him.
Yeah.
Feelings of guilt were such that, you know, this is in keeping with his personality and his life history. He wasn't going to not do what the Lord wanted him to do.
I think you really need to understand with the conversion of Saul, it was an absolute terrifying moment for Saul because he has just run into power. And the power says, you're against me. You're trying to hurt me. Yes. And I think he does understand his place. But I think there's a very basic reason for it. Whether he suffers or not doesn't change the truth that he just learned. The truth is Jesus lives. The truth is Jesus is the Lord. Keep that in mind because that is a very relevant message for all of us. There are going to be constant times when being a Christian might not seem like it is worth it. It might seem painful and difficult and filled with stress. You might be hurt by other people. It will not change what the truth is. And so even if you have to go through all the suffering, the truth is Jesus is still the Christ. He is still alive. He is still Lord. You stay on that path no matter what. Now with that, he's not just becoming a Christian. It's becoming an apostle and going and doing the work. And so why then would he do the work? And I think we've already been starting to answer that question. Why is he doing it even if he's going to be suffering? And maybe, I think there's a few thoughts to it. One is he thought the reward was worth the sacrifice. And I think we would agree with that. He certainly would say, argue that in Philippians 1. He thought the work was more important than the suffering. He's going out to declare the truth, the eternal truth. So what if he suffers? He's going to be saving souls. And I think potentially what Ashley was getting to, I think there's some truth to this as well. I think Saul had an understanding. It's only fair. I have been the one who has been persecuting Christians. Now I have become a Christian. It's kind of only fair that my life not be that great. I kind of deserve what's going to come. All right, so question number two then. How long does it take Paul to start preaching about Jesus publicly after his conversion? There's one word answer. Immediately is what it says in Acts chapter 9 and verse 20. Immediately he began. Why didn't he start off going to several seminars about how to be an evangelist?
I think Paul couldn't speak well.
Okay, so one, Paul's already got some education and he knows how to communicate. That's true enough. But the other part is, it's not that complicated for him to go and tell everybody, I changed because he's alive. This is what I have witnessed. He is a witness. That's what you go and do. But he started to preach immediately, and he preached effectively. In verse 22, he was proving that this Jesus is the Christ. Now, when we're looking in the book of Acts, we don't get the complete picture. The book of Galatians and chapter 1 has to meld with Acts chapter 9. And there are some differences. For example, in Galatians, it only talks about Paul going to Jerusalem twice, and the book of Acts has him going to Jerusalem three times. And we kind of have to resolve some of those things. But one of them is, in Galatians, Paul does not stay in Damascus the whole time. He is going to go out into, it says he goes into Arabia, and he is there for an undetermined amount of time, but then it is 3 years after his conversion that he goes down to Jerusalem. I just mentioned that just to be aware that at some point in here, in this particular section, Paul is preaching, and then Paul's not really there, and then Paul is back. And when he comes back, and he's still preaching, how do the people respond to him? And by that, I don't mean the disciples. How does everybody else respond to Paul? They're, well, before we get to them being afraid, that's the disciples. That's coming up. But it says here in verse 23, it says, when many days had elapsed, the Jews plotted together to do away with him. But their plot became known to Saul. They were also watching the gates day and night so that they might put him to death. How surprised is Paul that some people want to kill him?
He was in that same boat not too long ago.
Right? And there's this prophecy, you're going to suffer. Shock, here it started. It has started. And so they lower him from the wall through a gate, a basket, to the ground, and off he goes in the middle of the night. And so he escapes. He leaves Damascus. And where does he go? He's headed to Jerusalem. And he gets to Jerusalem, and this is what Paul always wants to do from here on out. When he gets to Jerusalem, who does he want to meet? Christians. This is Paul. Every place he goes, he's always looking up the Christians if they're around. So he's looking up the Christians, and how do they receive him, Bonnie?
They were afraid
of him, right? They were terrified. They did not believe that he had been converted. I think that this is just such an obvious thing from their perspective that they're looking at it saying, he is pretending to be a Christian so that he can catch us. Which, I guess, answers my next question is, can you blame them for being afraid of him? I think they've got a very plausible explanation as to what's going on. They look at him and say, he has been the cause of our persecution. Yeah, we don't want to meet with him. And so they were afraid of him. But how does that look to Saul, to Paul? He wants to meet with the Christians, and how's that go? Okay, this brings back little nightmares to me, because I remember being a kid, and I wanted friends, and my friends literally ran from me. They would run and hide, because they didn't... I wasn't cool enough for them. So imagine how that made me feel. Well, this is Paul. They're all running from him. Beyond that, what does it say? What are they saying about him when they run after he said, no, I'm a Christian? What do they believe about him or don't believe about him? Or, you know what, why don't I just answer my own question if I'm going to make it so difficult? But they have no faith in his ability to do what's right. They have no faith in his ability to change. Imagine being a part of church where everybody's afraid of you and they don't believe in you. How would that work? Well, I imagine for many people, for many newer Christians, they would quit. this isn't worth it. I mean, it's one thing for me to be chased away by the people who don't believe, but now I'm coming, where does he fit in the world? The non-believers want to kill him, and the believers want nothing to do with him. Where does he fit in? But he does not quit. And of course, it is Barnabas who steps up, and Barnabas brings him in and brings him to the apostles. And he talks to the apostles and he says, look, this is what happened to me. And when I was out there, I started preaching boldly. You can ask, there are disciples up there who are witness to these things. And then what does he start doing while he's in Jerusalem? He speaks out boldly in the name of the Lord in chapter 9 and verse 28. He was with them moving about freely in Jerusalem, speaking out boldly in the name of the Lord. Now, why might he have some trepidation about speaking out boldly in the name of the Lord right then? Because of what happened in Damascus. It's not like the people in Jerusalem are more reasonable. This is where the source, this is where he got the authority to go chase them to Damascus. And so, that's exactly what happens. There's a plot that comes out that they're going to try to get Paul. And so it's the disciples who save Paul. The very disciples that Paul had previously been trying to persecute now are the ones who send him away. He had scattered them and they kind of scatter him, but in a way they're doing it out of love and to try to save him. And this begins a pattern. I'm not going to have a slide. Do you see a pattern? I hope that you can see very quickly. Yes, there's a pattern. Paul preaches, Paul's persecuted, Paul flees. Paul preaches, Paul persecuted, Paul flees. And guess what? First missionary journey. Paul preaches, Paul's persecuted, he's chased. Second missionary journey, Paul preaches, Paul's persecuted, he's chased. Third missionary journey, they are still persecuting him. Next missionary journey, if you want to call it that, he's already in prison. This is his life. In that process, in the first missionary journey, he gets stoned. And this is found in Acts chapter 14. And it's really in verse 19 where it happens. Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having won over the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. So why did they just stone Paul?
Because he won over the multitude.
Because some people won over the multitude. And where were they from?
Outside.
Outside that is accurate. So these people are exactly like Paul used to be. They were not satisfied that Paul left their town. They're like, we got to go get him. We got to stop him. So they were in Antioch. They go to Iconium. Paul's left Iconium. The people in Iconium who were already upset at Paul join them, and now you have men from Antioch and Iconium chasing Paul. They come to Lystra, and they manage to convince everybody who had just a moment ago been trying to worship him as some of God. They now convince them, we probably ought to kill this guy. And so they try to kill him. And how successful are they from their perspective?
They stoned him thinking that he was there. Left him for dead.
Okay, so did they throw a few pieces of sand at him? No, something happens here to give us an indication of how thoroughly dead they thought he was. It's the order of events. They stone him and then drag him. Right? Now, if they dragged him out and then they stoned him, and so then, you know, he just kind of falls over. It's like a little pebble hits him. He's like, oh, and he falls down. That was my best Alex impersonation. We could, it's like, right? We fall down and then they just go, wait, you play dead. You can't really play dead like what he did. He has fallen down. He's not moving. And now they're dragging him and he's not making little grunting sounds. By the way, according to the law of Moses, they did that backwards. You're supposed to take them out of the city and then stone them because you're not supposed to have this blood guilt within the city. They were just a little zealous. But they think he's dead. So what's Paul do after that? because the disciples are gathered around, and I infer from this that they kind of think he's dead too. They followed him out and mourning him, and he gets up, which I'm sure was quite shocking for them. And where does he go? Which one was more shocking, that he got up or he went back to the city? That's pretty shocking. What's he do the next day? He leaves. He goes to Derbe, which is approximately the distance from Lystra as Antioch is. So he's not outside of the range that these people are willing to go. And what does he do when he gets to Derbe? What did he look like when he got to Derbe? Unless there's a miracle, and I see no indication of any miracles going on here, I'm not sure Paul will ever look the same after this moment. He has just had rocks thrown at him until they think he is thoroughly dead. And if he ever is going to look different, if he ever is going to recover from this, I know he didn't when he got to Derbe. I mean, I've seen people with black eyes, and those last a little while. This is black body. And he's going to go, and he's going to preach, and he is going to look pretty ugly. And he makes a lot of disciples when he gets to Derbe. And then he comes back through. And he comes back to Lystra. And he tells those Christians, through many tribulations, we must enter the kingdom of God. Visually, they're looking at him, and he says that. You think they got the concept? It may not be easy to be a Christian. Well, while we're on that subject, that's not the end of Paul's journey. It is not like he's been stoned and now life gets better and all easy for him. In fact, we see that there is an ongoing process for him, things that he endures. And so I've written out what has happened from those passages that I've given you. One that's frequently forgotten is 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32, where he fought with wild beasts at Ephesus. This is the idea of being thrown in the Colosseum as an entertainment for people. He had to fight wild beasts. Somehow he survived. He had multiple imprisonments. Look at this. Beaten times without number. I've lost count as to how many times people have punched me. 5 times the Jews gave him 39 lashes. 3 times he was beaten with rods. And of course we have the account we just saw where he was stoned. These things leave a mark. He was shipwrecked. He spent a night and a day in the deep. He was on frequent journeys, and with those came frequent dangers, rivers, robbers, countrymen, Gentiles, city dangers, wilderness dangers, sea dangers, dangers from false brethren. He had labor and hardship, sleepless nights, and the last one not to mention the internal emotional stress that he constantly faced, worried about brothers and sisters as they were falling away or facing temptation. By the way, that also, you can kind of see those things in people too. When somebody's really stressed and worried, you can see that. And I don't know how often this happened, but he says he was in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure, and that also will have a part on his body. And so in Galatians 6 and verse 17, when he says, "From now on, let no one cause trouble for me, for I bear on my body the brand marks of Jesus." When you think of Paul, don't think of a model. Think of someone who's been pulverized, and it shows. Now that's significant to me, because I'm not so sure that Paul would be a great preacher today. Do you think his appearance helped or hurt his ministry? Now, notice the first part of that question. Do you think? This is an opinion question. You are not wrong. Your opinion is perfectly valid, though I would like to hear the reasons, and the reasons are really important. Do you think that his damaged body helped or hurt his ministry?
Well, I can pose it another way. Just
no, you can't ask me the question back. Okay.
Have you ever observed a person who has served in the military who has been gravely injured and looked at him or her? What goes through your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Here's a soldier. Here's someone who stood up and fought. Paul, to me, is that kind of person.
Yes.
Yeah, even though he's beat up, he still stands up.
And for those who are online, Gary has made the comparison between wounded soldiers when we see them and hear them. Rod, what were you going to say?
I think it was in Isaiah. You may have to correct me. That it says that God's word will not return to him void.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the right kind of hearts, that we're listening to the message instead of the messenger.
Yes.
It should not matter.
But the bottom line is it could, but it depends on the audience, doesn't it? So I've seen both sides. You're not. There's no wrong opinion. His appearance hurt his ministry. For those who pay attention to what someone looks like, for those who were scared, like I'm terrified of following that religion. I might look like that. I might endure that. For people that were focused on how people sound, Paul isn't the preacher for you. Josh.
I think there's two sides of that coin for the people who are scared. One side might be, yeah, they're scared, they're afraid to go through that, but the other side might be the message of, look, this is worth it.
His appearance helped his ministry because it gave evidence that Paul was not a con man. I mean, how many people believe that religion is just some form of control, that people are doing it to make themselves rich? Who could look at Paul and say, you're doing this for your own good? You could not look at him and think that. He was not getting rich. He gave up everything to get beat up and brutalized. It gave reason to believe that Paul had indeed seen Jesus on the road to Damascus. Why else would he be so devoted and willing to go through so much? And also, it made Christians that followed him stronger. They were not surprised when life got hard. They had seen it firsthand on his body. Hey, Joyce, go ahead.
We have to remember that Paul did everything 100%, 110% before he was a Christian and after he was a Christian.
Mm.
To him, it didn't matter the persecution that he was going through because he knew he had the correct message. And he was going to deliver that no matter what. Nobody was going to stop him, just like nobody was going to stop him from persecuting Christians until Christ did.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anybody else could have except Christ.
No, I agree with that. I do. All right, so moving on. Despite all that Paul endured, many people seemed to doubt his apostleship, and that must have been frustrating to have gone through all of this and have people doubt whether you're really an apostle or not. If you look with me in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, look at verse 1, and it's really in 1 and 2 Corinthians where he's having to deal with this. But in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 1, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? We can hear within that there was accusations that he wasn't. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, in verse 19, he says, all this time you've been thinking that we are defending ourselves to you. Well, so he's thinking the whole letter now. You guys think this is me defending myself. And there's reason for that. He kind of is. He has to defend whether he's even an apostle in front of them. So why would people challenge whether Paul was an apostle? Well, I think there's a lot of reasons to that. Some of them aren't the ones you would normally think of. We've already talked a little bit about Paul's apostleship was different. He wasn't following Jesus when he was in his earthly ministry through Galilee. He didn't meet the qualifications that we saw in Acts chapter 1 that Matthias had to meet. So you could look at that. And there's a little bit of that right here, because what's his next question? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? That's part of the question. It's like, well, have you really been a witness? Yes, he has. He has been a witness. But if you keep going on 1 Corinthians chapter 9, one of the challenges is he's not married. And Peter is married. The apostles live this way, you live that way. Are you really an apostle? He worked to be self-supported, a tent maker. Are you really an apostle if you're going to do that? And then I think I've got the wrong reference here. 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 13. The aggravation here from Paul. For in what respect were you treated as inferior to the rest of the churches, except that I myself did not become a burden to you? Forgive me this wrong. They're upset with him because he didn't charge them for his services. And possibly, I think there's an argument in 2 Corinthians 4 that they think maybe he's not an apostle. Maybe he's not even pleasing to God, because look at his body. Look at how he's been beaten up so badly. And there's also this argument about he said he would come to Corinth and he didn't come to Corinth and right when he said he would. And they said he clearly is not an apostle. Paul has to deal with this. When you get into public service, people will judge every aspect of your life. That's what Paul's dealing with. And now they're challenging whether he's correctly an apostle or not. Now go back to that 2 Corinthians 12, verse 19. All this time you have been thinking that we are defending ourselves to you. Actually, it is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ and all for your upbuilding, brethren. So why did Paul defend himself? And it was not because Paul was like, I have suffered for Jesus and I will be treated like the apostle I deserve to be treated. I will get the honor and glory that I deserve in this position. He doesn't do it for himself at all. He does it for their upbuilding. Put in different ways, in the next verse, he didn't want to disappoint them. He didn't want them to disappoint him. I think what he's talking about is this next point. He wanted the doubters to get their act together before they had to face Paul the apostle. See, if you look at 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 19, there are people that are challenging Paul. And here's what he says. I will come to you soon if the Lord wills, and I shall find out not the words of those who are arrogant, but their power. I'm coming and I am an apostle. Get your act together. 2 Corinthians 12 verse 21. I'm afraid that when I come again, my God may humiliate me before you and I may mourn over many of those who have sinned in the past and not repented of the impurity, immorality, and sensuality which they have practiced. Paul is coming and he is coming with the power and will to rebuke and discipline if necessary. You guys need to understand he's an apostle. So you get your act together. But he's not doing it to defend himself. So Paul and his part of Paul brings some of this on himself. And I don't want to say that. That's not exactly right. Some of the things Paul says are taken out of context and used against him. One of those things is in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 9, where he refers to himself as the least of the apostles. Not even fit to be called an apostle. It says in the list of Jesus' appearances after his resurrection, for I am the least of the apostles and not fit to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. Well, people latch onto that. So Paul has to give to the same church a different description. In 2 Corinthians 11 verse 5, he is in no respect inferior to the most eminent apostles. In chapter 12 and verse 12, he says, I give the signs of a true apostle. So what do you think Paul means in that first part where he says, I am the least of the apostles? What's he mean by that? He tells us actually, right, in that verse. Why is he the least? Because I was the worst. I was the one who persecuted the Christians. The other apostles have been following Jesus the whole time and I've been chasing you. I'm not fit. I'm not worthy. Was Paul any less of an apostle because he felt that way? No. He says, I am in no respect inferior to the most eminent apostles. What's he mean by that?
He wasn't a junior apostle.
He is a full apostle. Full power, full revelation, full inspiration. His word is just as authoritative as the others. It also means if, let's say, there was a conflict between, I don't know, Peter and Paul, was Paul going to back down? No. If Peter was wrong, Paul stood up. And Paul would rebuke Peter. Say, Peter, you are wrong. Paul was no inferior apostle. It's actually a ludicrous question for us. I mean, we get along after having read the New Testament. Nobody comes away from the New Testament thinking, Paul, I'm not so sure about that guy. I mean, he wrote like half the New Testament. He's just incredible as an individual. We hold him in much higher standard. All right, so quickly, as we're getting near the end, how many missionary journeys did Paul go on? It's kind of a trick question. It depends on how you look at it.
Three.
Three and a half. And even then, I mean, really, if you started with him at Damascus and he goes down to Jerusalem, that kind of counts. But yeah, we have three missionary journeys. First missionary journey is to Turkey. Second missionary journey, Turkey and Greece. Third missionary journey, mostly Greece. And then he comes and he has this prison journey in which he goes up to Caesarea and then over to Rome, mix in a few of a shipwreck in there. All right. So why did Paul, what was his principle? And Romans 15 verse 20 tells us that Paul had a principle as to where he was going. It wasn't a constant principle. It's not like he always did this. But he set his sight on going to Spain, and his reason why was because he wanted to preach where Jesus hadn't been taught before. Thus I aspired to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, so that I would not build on another man's foundations. And so now he has this goal, and in the next few verses, I'm trying to get to Spain. I'm trying to get further. And that was Paul. Paul's the expansion of the gospel. It goes from Judea and Samaria with Peter and the other apostles, and then Paul, remotest parts of the earth. That's not to say the other apostles didn't do anything. We just don't know about it. Paul's the focus for us in the spread of the gospel. So which New Testament books did he write? This is really easy because we put them in order in the Bible for you. Not as in order as to when he wrote them, but it's all like it's the Paul section. You get the Gospels, you get Acts, you get Paul. And then you get some others. So, you start off with Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, Philemon, and of course, Hebrews, which we always put the question mark on afterwards, because he didn't sign Hebrews. But for the first few centuries, there was a pretty much unanimous thought that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, and I tend to believe them, but I will always say the author of Hebrews, because we don't know for certain. So here's our last question with our last few minutes, and it is, you know, not an easy question to answer in just a few moments, but what did you learn about Paul? Who was Paul? If somebody asked you to describe Paul, how would you describe his character, his personality? Gary?
Pardon me, but I'm
going to
say he's a good soldier.
He's a good soldier. That's going to cover a lot of things that I put up there. But yeah, hard worker, endurance.
Committed.
Committed. He definitely had commitment. I like the idea of this zeal, this 100%. I mean, whether he was right or wrong, he was going to go full force through. So when he thought that Christianity was wrong, full force, he's going to be the number one enemy of Christianity. Once he realizes Christianity is right, full force, 100%, number one supporter of Christianity. He loved Christians. You know, even though he would have a lot of trouble with Christians, in Philippians, he talks about how some Christians were trying to cause him harm. But he would say in Colossians, chapter 2, For I want you to know how great a struggle I have on your behalf and for those who are at Laodicea and for all those who have not personally seen my face, that their hearts may be encouraged, having been knit together in love and attaining to all the wealth that comes from the full assurance of understanding, resulting in a true knowledge of God's mystery, that is Christ himself. A love even for the ones who haven't seen him, who he's never met before. Paul certainly had that. I don't know that I could possibly do justice of describing Paul and his character. I put him as a man who cared about Christians. He was patient, putting up with a lot from Christians and non-Christians. He loved Jesus above everything. He was willing to give up everything and endure anything, he says, for the surpassing knowledge of knowing Jesus. He had incredible endurance, zeal, and conscience. He was a man with self-control. He describes that in 1 Corinthians 7. He chose not to get married. That's not always an easy choice. He was, I don't know how to put this one. I put it down as practical in this debate about whether they should bring John Mark with them or not. And Paul's looking at it saying, look, John Mark failed us. I don't think we should bring him along on this mission. But then he proves himself to be somebody who gives people second chances, because later on he writes, I have use for John. I have use for Mark. Bring him with you. Boy, a lot we could say about Paul. All right, next week I have really only three questions. We're going to look at the apostles as a whole, as our examples. We're going to kind of do what we're doing right here. We're going to look at, what do we learn from these guys? How are we supposed to live? And I plan to talk a little bit about the challenge of them being examples when they weren't always perfect, and how we can still trust them as our example. But we will wrap that up for, that's this, it for this class. Looking forward to the next class, Lord willing. We're coming to an end of this series. It is wrapping up, but it's been good. All right, so Dennis, I believe you have the closing prayer. Let's go ahead and have that then.